Hi there, my name is Nikki Bozanoff, and you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3 FM. On last week's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we heard from Dr. Mark Epricht, a professor at Queen's University who studies the history of same-sex partnerships in sub-Saharan Africa. On part two of that topic, today's episode, we take a look at the epidemiology of HIV among men who have sex with men in sub-Saharan Africa. We try to understand why criminalization of same-sex partnerships leaves individuals at greater risk. With us on the show is Dr. Stefan Barral, a physician epidemiologist who has recently joined the Department of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Center of Public Health and Human Rights. Dr. Barral is part of one of the first research groups to consider the question of HIV among men who have sex with men in sub-Saharan Africa and has since been at the forefront of this research. We look forward to speaking with him.
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi, Dr. Barral.
Hi.
So as I told you, last week we did an interview with Dr. Epricht, and I know that you've been working for some time on looking at the epidemiology of HIV among men who have sex with men in sub-Saharan Africa, so I'm wondering if you can tell me how the research question arose for you.
Have continued working from there.
Maybe you can tell me a little bit about how criminalization of same-sex partnerships in some of the countries you were speaking about affect people's ability to practice sex safely or to access care.
Sure. So, you know, I work at a Center for Public Health and Human Rights, and so we focus on sort of the conflation or the interaction between the two. Now, I mean, there's a series of different levels of risk factors for gay men and other MSM, and, you know, those start at things like unprotected anal intercourse, you know, general ulcerative diseases, multiple male partners, practicing of transactional sex or compensated sex. Those are individual level risk factors that likely hold true between regions. So whether you're gay in Canada or whether you're gay in you know, Kenya, those are likely going to mediate risk for HIV. But there are a series of these higher order risk factors that you start getting into, of which criminalization is one, and where the differences, where you start seeing differences in drivers of the epidemic. So, you know, going from individual level risk factors and thinking to like network level risk factors in terms of how hidden your network has to be, which is very related to, you know, how willing you might be to seek care, you know, the uptake of preventive services within your own social or sexual network. And then thinking up to community level factors like people being afraid to walk in their own community, you know, high levels of community stigma, high level, any sort of targeted and preventive services available within the community so that people don't have to travel far and wide for somebody to understand their issues. And then moving up into these sort of public policy pieces like criminalization. And so, I mean, criminalization is extreme in terms of its effects, and it has numerous effects. One is it affects the ability to provide services, right? So it affects, you know, even if there was a brave provider out there who wanted to do these things, first of all, they have no means to be trained in how to do them appropriately, right? Just because it's not part of medical school or nursing or counseling curriculum. The second piece, and even if they did want to do it, I mean, they take great personal risk in terms of doing of providing those services, because what they're being known as is providing services to an illegal or criminalized population. So, I mean, there's a whole dynamic there. There's a second dynamic in terms of uptake of those services. And so a lot of these men are living otherwise normal lives, right? They're otherwise married. They're otherwise have children, because there's a lot of questions that happen when you're 35 years old, unmarried, in the region. And so a lot of men have to live these double lives. And so they seek care as straight men and receive care as straight men. They're just never really asked the question. And so, you know, the willingness of people to self-identify as being gay or as being, you know, as having same-sex practices tends to be limited, because you really put yourself at risk. And if you don't understand what the benefits are of that, which in reality, in many places, they're very limited, most people are not going to want to self-identify. And so therefore, their risk is going to be underappreciated. I mean, if you ask somebody, you know, how many female partners do you have? And they say either zero or one, I'm married. And that could very well be true. Then, you know, you're going to classify that person's risk status as being really quite low, as compared to just asking the question, you know, do you also have sex with men? And then understanding that the risk status is high. And the second thing is that when HIV infections happen among those men, you know, asking about same-sex practices in that region is not, you know, is not common. And so therefore their risk gets misattributed to other risk factors. And so, you know, I think, so there's a series of different pieces. Criminalization also affects the ability to provide any sort of targeted education throughout high school and university. But it's not just criminalization. So in South Africa is a good example where, you know, the constitution was changed in 96, sorry. And, you know, I mean, there's still a serious amount of what we would consider human rights violations of these men, especially in the townships. The only thing that we've really seen from an epidemiological standpoint is that men's access to care is much better, because there's a legal mandate to provide care. But other than that, people are still afraid to walk in their own communities. There's still a lot of blackmail. There's a lot of violence. And so those things, you know, still take a long time to change. And clearly in the last, you know, 17 years since the laws have been changed, that they're still working on it.
And when you were trying to get grants for your research, and as you continue to try and conduct this research, have you come up against many of those barriers?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Canada, you know, it's really about the science. You know, you really have to make a scientific, for scientific ranking bodies, right, mm-hmm. different other ranking bodies, but you have to make the case that the science is doable, that you can accrue men, that you can retain them. It's a prevention program that you can actually operationalize this prevention, and that it's going to have some efficacy or effectiveness, and it's going to contribute to science in some way. They're not so big on the human rights questions generally. We can sort of add those in terms of making the case that, you know, human rights are inherently linked to any of those pieces, right? So making the case that if we want to accrue men, we have to guarantee their human rights in some way in terms of making it so that they're going to come to clinic, that they're not going to be, you know, in danger for doing that, etc. So there's a series of different pieces there. So, you know, from the NIH perspective, you know, these studies that we've been doing have laid the groundwork of saying that, you know, this is a high-risk cohort of men that are present, that are prevalent, and that are accruable and want to partake in studies because it's a way of guaranteeing them services that aren't currently available. The other piece of it is actually going to in-country and actually trying to make these pieces happen. And, you know, we work in a model that is very community-oriented. And so, you know, we look to the community for leadership in terms of community-based organizations that support these men in each country. And that's always been the way that we've done it, and that is, you know, we believe that through and through. We believe in capacity building. We believe in people presenting their own data, et cetera. And so, you know, that's how we access men, and that's our model. It's always been that model. The question is just, how do we get ethical approval? Now, you know, so ethical approval in these countries tends to be done not necessarily through universities, but generally speaking through government, or at least there's government representation on each of the institutional review boards. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're asking to do work with a criminalized population, and one that carries, for some reason, disproportionate stigma as compared to the other criminalized populations like sex workers and drug users. And one that it just strikes a nerve, I think, mostly from a religious standpoint and a legacy of a lot of things that are, you know, sort of relevant in the history of Africa. And, you know, it tends to be very difficult, and it tends to be, you know, each country has to have an appropriate strategy for itself, and it takes years in some places. In some places, we've been threatened that the police are going to come to our hotel and arrest us and yada, yada, yada. So, I mean, sometimes it's been good, sometimes it's been bad, but, I mean, we've worked our way through. As an example, in one country, we were declined approval to do it based on, you know, sort of they sent back a letter with like 15 different reasons why, and we just took it as a letter from any IRB or any institutional review board and basically just answered those 15 questions, and then about 8 months later got approval. So, you know, we've done this work now in, I think, 13 countries, mm-hmm. and in each country it's been an individual process. Now, the one thing that's changing, though, is that we've gone from, you know, not being able to see the government to save our lives to being invited right in to meet with the government to discuss these things. So, and that's because of a series of different international players starting to support this work, like the Global Fund and like UNAIDS and like UNGAST indicators, the UN General Assembly Special Section on HIV/AIDS indicators that are motivating countries to play along with us.
In the regions where you do have good data, or are there regions where you do have good data?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think the question is, good data is sort of like, it's a conflated term. We've developed a system that we call HASTE, which stands for the Highest Attainable Standard of Evidence. And, you know, for example, in this piece, I mean, we have prevalence data. I mean, good data in my mind is HIV incidence data. From a longitudinal cohort, which is sort of like the Cadillac model of good data. And then, you know, there's sort of more like the Toyota model where you have prevalence data, you have, you know, markers of risk that are cross-sectional, so that aren't really causal but are associated factors. And then there's the rickshaw model where you just sort of pull everybody together, just do a convenient sample and just do a behavioral assessment. So in some places we have rickshaw data, in some places we have Toyota data, and we're definitely moving towards where it's indicated Cadillac data in terms of where we're preventing for large-scale programs. To some extent, that's reflective of the levels of funding that we had in the past and the levels of funding that we now have. So in the past, we were doing this with funders from the Open Society Institute, which is George Soros' fund. And the grants, they're not really health funder very small, you know, maybe $10,000 a country. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we were working pro bono. The money would just go to the community group to actually help them implement this piece. You know, and just limited things. You can actually do a lot for a little bit of money, but you're still limited ultimately in sort of the size and scope and magnitude of what you can generate. We're now moving towards larger studies that are NIH-funded that allow us, and NCIHR-funded, that allow us to, you know, carry, to develop a sort of a stronger, more methodologically sound data set, which is specifically in preparation for prevention studies.
Mm-hmm.
So you asked me about where we have these data. So in terms of where we have good data, just to get back to actually answering your question, where we actually have good data is parts of Southern Africa. I believe we have good data in Malawi. I believe now we have good data in South Africa. We are in the process of generating data in Swaziland. We have more sort of like a lower Toyota model data in Namibia and Botswana. And we have nice data. And then moving over to West Africa, we have nice, really good data in Senegal. We've generated some data now in Guinea-Bissau and are starting in other countries in West Africa. And then others have collected nice data in Ghana and Nigeria as well. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've noticed that in some of the publications, there's talk about how men may have concurrent partnerships with men and with other women. So, how much of that research is about trying to get funders to realize that this could have an impact on the larger population rather than, you know, this group of largely marginalized men? I mean, if it was up to you, would you focus on the men who have sex with men, or do you think that this argument of showing that there's risk to the general population is important?
I think there's a few reasons why we do that work, and it's always sort of a contentious piece, but the key is that we always do it with guidance from our local community partners in terms of whatever strategies that we take and however we write our papers, and every word that goes into those papers is discussed in a member checking or community validation meetings before it's written. But I mean, so there's a few reasons why we do that. One is, you know, there's a lot of talk that the African epidemic is really driven by, especially in Southern Africa, is driven by multiple concurrent partnerships,
mm-hmm.
and men having multiple female partners. And there's large scale programs. I mean, really, really large scale programs called One Love programs that focus on decreasing partnerships and focusing to some extent building on the ABC model, the abstinence behavior change and condom model, and decreasing concurrent sexual partnerships and decreasing sexual partnerships in general. That piece is so heterosexually oriented that it completely excludes anything other than heterosexual partnerships. One of the pieces that we wanted to put forward is saying not all concurrency is heterosexual concurrency. There are components of men, like as you said, men having male partners and men having female partners. That is also a piece of that. So you may want to include, if you really want to have a comprehensive program, you may want to include the component of, you know, men having sex with men as well. So you may want to include a component of that into One Love program. And we actually think that that would be relatively easy to do, not a major investment, and would address a huge underserved need right now. You know, realistically, men are going to, you know, gay men, even men who feel themselves as gay, not just men who practice same-sex practices, are going to have female partners in the continent for a long time to come, just like men cruise the streets in Canada and the U.S. and still are married at home. And the reason that is because, it, you know, from a life perspective, their general life is easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they don't have to answer questions in the same way, especially if they're from places where there's just a significant amount of stigma associated with being gay or having male partners. And so that's going to happen for a long time to come. And what we wanted to try and understand, the scientific question was, do men sort of appreciate where their risk is coming from? Because most men actually believe, as what has been taught in, you know, Africa and beyond for a long time, is that HIV lives in the vagina, and the risk is really mediated by vaginal intercourse. And that the risk is, you know, and most men, you know, whether you ask them, still feel that way, that the risk that they get when they have multiple concurrent partnerships or bisexual concurrent partnerships is really from the women. Mm-hmm. And they actually tend to wear condoms more with the women than they do with men to reflect that risk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of one piece. I mean, there's definitely a piece in there about trying to make governments understand that these are not isolated epidemics. And there's a few different ways of doing that. Again, there's sort of the Cadillac way and maybe the Toyota way. The Toyota way is the way that we've to date done it, which is saying that, you know, these partnerships, you know, that these men, excluding them, ignoring them, criminalizing them, beating them, arresting them, none of those things will ever help you comprehensively address your epidemic. You know, we try and tend to take a very collaborative approach to governments because our partners still need to work in the countries after we finish our papers and after we do our research. And so while some of our partners, partner organizations, you know, condemn governments, write very aggressive pieces, it tends to not actually help the group that still wants to work in that country and live in that country because you're responsive to the government in terms of them shutting you down. So that's not been our approach. Our approach has been trying to provide sort of, you know, like a technical support to the government, saying this is not a meaningful or an evidence-based way of addressing your epidemic in terms of excluding these men. And one piece of showing that is showing that, you know, a lot of them are married. Now, it's not about blaming, right? Because actually, if you've never educated men that there's really a lot of risk associated with having other male partners, then it's very difficult to blame them for having those male partnerships. And so, you know, that's been one element to it. So there's been that sort of educational piece to it. The Cadillac version is just doing molecular analyses and showing that the circulating strains in men, in gay men or MSM, is the same as in the general population. And that work's been done in Kenya and Senegal and has shown that it's exactly the same strain. That maybe when it started it wasn't, but now the circulating recombinant strains in MSM are the same as they are in general population, showing that these are not isolated epidemics. It's the same virus going back and forth.
That's really interesting. So you've mentioned briefly about the community organizations that you've worked with, and I mean, obviously HIV has had a profound impact on human rights movements, the gay rights movement in North America, the right to access to treatment in Southern Africa. So can you tell me about what that looks like on the ground? What does this mobilization look like?
Well, so I mean, a lot of the groups are very early stage. I'd say sort of the earliest groups that have formed dealing with MSM specifically in sub-Saharan Africa date back to outside of South Africa, date back to about 2005 or so, 2004, 2005. And so these are, you know, these tend to be members of the community, right, community at risk that look at their peers and say, you know, there's something happening here and we need to do something about it. A lot of these guys tend to be otherwise employed. There's not a lot of money, especially in the very, very early stages. And when, I mean, there's really not a lot of money in terms of doing this work. And so most men will have other jobs, you know, that pay their support sort of 3 or 4 days a week and then still do 40 hours of work a week related to, you know, this work, this community mobilization effort. One of the things that we've really worked on is making sure that our community groups have been funded so as to actually be able to do this full time, because it's incredibly powerful when they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's one thing about having sort of, you know, 15 or 20 actual daylight hours to work on something and doing the rest at night and weekends, as compared to actually being mandated to do this as part of your work piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's been a lot of learning from the mobilization effort that happened in the early 80s in the U.S. and Canada and beyond. I'd say mostly the U.S., though. I don't know that many Canadian organizations that have gotten involved in this work. And so, you know, looking at groups like AVAC, the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, ACT UP, CID Action, other groups that's a French group, that have supported these initiatives across Africa, looking at their brothers and sisters in Africa and seeing them going through very similar struggles as to what happened in the late 70s, pre-HIV in terms of STIs in the early 80s with the emergence of HIV in the U.S. and Canada. And so I think that there's been a lot of sharing of lessons. And so they've been able to skip maybe some of the, you know, the part that didn't work in terms of that advocacy component and focus on the things that do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that part has been, you know, has been wonderful. In general, the groups have fallen into two main buckets, and so one of them is a human rights focused perspective, and the other is like a health focused perspective. Mm-hmm. And I'll start with the human rights piece. And so the human rights piece are groups that are fighting for recognition, are fighting, you know, for legal change in terms of decriminalization, are fighting for, you know, increased rights and those pieces. And that is incredibly important, incredibly important. The issue with that part, the difficulties that some of them have had is that there is a really limited set of funds available for that work. So the funders that you're looking to tend to be smaller scale funders that give between $3,000 to $5,000 grants to do, you know, a specific advocacy piece or a specific mobilization piece.
Mm-hmm.
While it's incredibly important, like I said, I mean, it just really tends to be limited in time in terms of the scale and scope of what the things that you can accomplish with those funds are. The other group has tended to be sort of this public health approach. And that's more probably the partners that we've had in the sense that, you know, this is research, it's research about HIV. And the reason that we do that is because governments are able to understand that language a little bit better. You know, human rights is so interesting because human rights across Africa has become like, to some extent, even the term elicits anger in some people. And so we even don't use the term in a lot of places. And my card that I hand out there doesn't say anything about me working at a center for human rights. You know, it really focuses, we talk about things like structural barriers to care, about, you know, structural risk factors, about violence and blackmail and how that affects, you know, testing rates and, you know, HIV prevalence and to some extent incidence. And so, you know, we work on human rights. You know, we believe the work that we do is related to an expanded definition of human rights, related to both how the UN Declaration of Human Rights defines it, in addition to broader pieces, like I said, coverage of services, access to services, you know,
mm-hmm.
Anyways, in a series of pieces that we consider covered under that umbrella. And that's the approach that we've taken. Now, they've tended to be able to access, you know, sort of a broader broader support in terms of being able to work on the Global Fund mediated grants, on partnerships with us, and we're actually able to support our partners to do research in a way that actually supports their organization. And so that's been a very symbiotic relationship. You know, I mean, it is a pure collaborative piece, and there's been some that we've had to call off because the group didn't want to move on, which we always respect, and that's their decision. And other places where we've concentrated, where the groups have really seen the value from the angle that we've taken as compared to others. And so, you know, there's lots of different people doing different pieces, and the groups that want to focus exclusively on human rights pieces, you know, there's likely better partners for them that can help them achieve their goals.
Mm-hmm.
So just to say, again, summarize, you know, it's been really two bilateral partnerships moving forward. The one focused on human rights, and the other one focused on public health, which also I think mirrors what happened here. 30, you know, 35 years ago,
mm-hmm.
was that it was the same sort of piece, and both of them have had struggles with each other moving forward, have been angry to some extent at each other in terms of the approaches that they've taken, but have always been useful to each other and advanced together. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the questions I have for the interview part. Is there anything that you want to add to that?
No, I mean, I think it's wonderful that we're having this conversation. I mean, I think that if your readers are interested in learning more, they can go. If you just Google Center for Public Health and Human Rights, it comes mm-hmm. right to our website at Johns Hopkins. They can contact us if you know people are interested in getting involved with this work. It is still a body of work that people are definitely paying more attention to, but it's not that people are really dedicating their lives to it. So there's always room for work if people are interested, especially students. So.
Okay, thanks. That's it for today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective. My name is Nikki Bosnoff, and you're listening to CFMU 93.3 FM. If you like what you heard, you can find us online at healthjusticeradio.wordpress.com. We'll talk to you next week.